Folks, after 4 years of expansive whole of government regulatory initiatives from the Biden administration on climate, equity, social policy, infrastructure, and technology, the net effect of all of that was the fattest federal register ever seen. And the cornerstone of the Trump of Donald Trump's campaign was deregulation. And joining us is Wayne Cruz, Fred Fellow in Regulatory Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Wayne, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, and Happy New Year.
Same to you, my friend. And I love the way that you, and my lead-in was right out of your article where you talk about this Federal Register being the fattest it's ever seen. Obviously, it was chock full with a lot of craziness. Trump promised that he would thinning this up a little bit. How did he do?
Well, he did pretty good when you're talking about conventional rules and regulations published in the Federal Register. Biden had the fattest Federal Register ever, which is the that's the daily depository of all the rules and regulations that are being pumped out like chocolate bunnies across all of the bureaucracy and all the alphabet soup agencies. And before Biden, it was Obama that had the record-setting Federal Register. And, of course, Trump number one came in at that time. Trump number one had a one-in, two-out kind of mode of operation. The new Trump era called for one-in, ten-out. And at least if you go by the conventional types of rules that are published in the Federal Register, you know, from environmental agencies, the Energy Department, the Labor Department, Department of Transportation, rules and regulations in 2025 basically stopped. I called it the year of the unrule, where Biden had a Federal Register of 106,000 pages. Trump clocked in at around 61,000 pages, so getting around roughly half the level. But a lot of the Trump rules and regulations that were published were the kind of typical things like Coast Guard rules or aircraft worthiness certifications from the FAA. There was no real mega regulation taking place like we had with Biden, with his tailpipe emission standards and the DEI provisions being set up across the federal government, the appliance efficiency standards and so forth. Trump not only froze Biden regulations. In fact, early in 2025, the administration had claimed they had saved over $1 trillion by just freezing the proposed Biden rules. But in addition to that, Congress has enacted this year over a dozen so-called resolutions of disapproval, and they were signed by Trump, so they were actually public laws, overturning really, really costly Biden rules and regulations. And the other interesting thing is about every year there's roughly 3,000 rules and regulations, or more than that. But way back in the 70s, you could have over 7,000 rules, but typically it's 3,000. Trump, in addition to having a Federal Register slimmed down to 61,000 pages, just issued the lowest number of rules and regulations in history. So Trump had about 2,400 rules and regulations in the Federal Register. That was better than he did in his first term. He was around 2,800 during one of his years. But most of those, a lot of those rules and regulations were rollback, what I called the unrules I'd mentioned a second ago, the rollbacks, the delays of enforcement, the relaxations, things of that sort. Under the Trump administration, there effectively were no new major regulatory undertakings of the typical kind. Now, Trump has other things that people complain about that are interventionist and regulatory in that sense, like the tariffs, his kind of affinity for price controls and pharmaceuticals and even concert ticket prices. And I was joking, well, heck, if the free market can't handle price of entertainment, what can it handle? So you've got, a few little aberrations or discordant notes with the Trump administration. And of course, probably the most serious of those are his proclivities toward partial nationalizations of companies like Intel and MP Materials and things like that. But on the whole, when you're talking about conventional rules and regulation, that stuff has basically just stopped. And it's pretty fascinatingly interesting to see what happens in 2026. Well, that's I would say that's a quick overview, but that wasn't very quick. But I hope that kind of gives you a feel.
It really does, Wayne, and we really appreciate it. We're speaking with Wayne Cruz, the Fred L. Smith Fellow in Regulatory Studies at Competitive Enterprise Institute, otherwise known as CEI. You follow this closely. Can you give my listening audience, because I've actually gone to the Federal Register several times. People have brought things to my attention, about some crazy. In fact, there was this one rule. Farmers, if there was water that appeared in a stream, if there was a stream like on their property and there was a rock within so many feet of the high water mark of the stream that was larger than 12 inches in diameter, they had to get a permit to move the rock. I mean, that's how crazy some of this stuff. I didn't believe it. They tell me the story. Yeah. I said, I don't believe it. So I had to go read it. I found it. It was there. It was true. And it was like, this is absolute craziness. What is some of the craziest stuff you've seen in the Register?
Oh, gosh. There's so much of it. To me, the worst stuff are the energy efficiency standards. And they're for everything now. Chainsaws, washing machines, dishwashers. It used to be you could get dishwashers that would actually clean your dishes, and they would even have garbage disposals included in them. And now, you got to hand wash your dishes and use your dishwasher for a dryer. But EPA regulations, if anybody listening has lately gone to Home Depot or Walmart and bought a gas can, these contraptions, you got to have three hands to manipulate them. You end up spilling and wasting and evaporating more gas than you would just with a water bottle, pouring it in. Yeah. So a lot of things that the government does is just counterproductive. And, Trump has stopped a lot of it. And, the world doesn't end. And it's important to stress, too, if you got folks who say, well, regulations protect us. Well, that's true. But it's not just the case that you only get protection or regulation from thinking up a value and then naming an agency after it, like transportation or energy. Free markets not only have the role or play the role of creating new products and services, but they also need to evolve the disciplinary measures alongside. And so, with respect to crazy regulations and such, you can find a lot of them, but I think a lot of, in a certain sense, I joke, all tainted meat was approved by the USDA. just because you have a regulatory agency doesn't mean you're getting maximum protection and regulation. You could also be setting floors and discarding the competition that's needed to really create actual safety and regulation. But you mentioned that water example. Some of the environmental rules have just gotten really out of hand, and that's what's been rolled back under the Trump administration. The tailpipe standards for automobiles, for example, fuel economy standards, and some of those energy conservation standards that I just mentioned as well. They just go too far. They try to do good things, but they may not necessarily work. And I just stress the role of markets in regulation, because markets will, any company operating in a free enterprise system where there's rule of law and prohibitions against fraud and harm and things has got upstream business suppliers, downstream business customers, Wall Street, the media, advertisers. All of these forces are arrayed against companies that misbehave. And often when you just sweep that aside and throw out regulations, you end up hurting the public rather than helping. So it's interesting to me. It's great to see what attempts are being made. So far, Trump, instead of one in 10 out, the administration recently put out a report saying they'd done 128 out for every one in, and are saving around $200 billion in regulatory costs, which I reckon, $20 billion a year so far. And we'll see what 2026 brings.
The other thing to this that we don't ever, hardly ever quantify is the time that we spend in the adoption in the rulemaking process. And what really drives me crazy is when we're adopting rules that are not even, and from an engineering perspective, from a science perspective, achievable. And they admit that. They admit it.
Yeah.
And we put it in as a rule anyway. It's like, you know, yeah, like gas mileage. I don't know that, you know, our engines? My mind just went blank.
Internal combustion.
Thank you, sir.
Electric.
Yeah. Internal. I don't know that internal combustion engines are going to achieve 50 miles a gallon.
Right.
You know, if it could, it would have. Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
the idea, you know, if you even think that the administrative state approach is the way that you actually get regulation, and I'm a skeptic of that. You would want to set, you know, certain kind of performance goals rather than technical standards and see what can evolve. But, you know, the rules can be too strict, and that's what we end up doing. When you were talking about moving the rocks and needed a permit to do that, the Waters of the United States rule is one of the major things that, you know, with respect to wetlands, one of the major things that the Trump administration had been working on reformatting, just because it goes too far. Our former general counsel used to say it shouldn't be the Waters of the United States rule, it should be the Moistures of the United States rule, because that's basically how they treat it, you know, as a damp spot, as a navigable water. So that's one of the things that happens too. You know, you get a rule, even if it's well intended, you have people downstream who love power, love writing new rules, love extending the heavy weight that it imposes, and then they claim when they even stoop to doing a benefit cost analysis, you know, they always claim that the benefits surpass the costs. And, you know, that's one of the things that's changing now. And not only that, now we see it's a good development, too, that the Trump administration has brought independent agencies like the financial outfits, like Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the SEC, and, you know, on the economic regulatory side, like the Federal Communications Commission, that were independent agencies are now brought under regulatory review. So it seems that there's going to be more attention paid to costs and benefits of rules. So far, though, the administration has been late putting out some of its reports. But I think we can get back on here on the phone in the coming weeks. I'm compiling a new edition of our annual report that I call 10,000 Commandments, and I'll be assessing, you know, the Trump administration's 2025 in even more depth and comparing it to past history, but looking at things we might be able to do to make things work better in the future in terms of these streamlinings and rollbacks. So far, for example, you know, we don't have yet of the Trump streamlining program, we have not yet had Congress back it up with legislation to make it permanent. And this, you know, of course, if that's not done, same thing could happen that happened after the first Trump term. There were successes in regulatory streamlining, but on day one, when Biden came in, he swept it all aside with a memoranda that he called Modernizing Regulatory Review. That was the title of it, but it was just basically ending regulatory review rather than modernizing it. So we'll continue to have this debate. I just think it's important when folks kind of on the free market or libertarian side are debating this with folks, that they make the point that you can't, your choice is never regulation or no regulation. It's just whether you really believe that these kind of political disciplines are going to do the job, or whether you need to expand the scope of competitive disciplines and make better end results that way, both economically and socially, and, well, other ways too, health and so forth. You were talking about paperwork and all. I was the one late report is the so-called information collection budget, where the Trump administration, well, any administration, reports on hours of paperwork. Last I checked, last time we had a report under Joe Biden, I was tallying up that it takes, you know, the equivalent of 16,000 human lifetimes a year to deal with all the federal red tape. So instead of red tape, you know, dead tape.
That's a crime.
And I'm hoping that when we get a new edition of that report from the Trump administration, we should see, in addition to the cost savings the administration has boasted about already, that we see some savings in terms of those just hours of spent of shuffling paperwork.
Do we quantify? I mean, a lot of this ends up in litigation too, right?
Yeah.
So, are we tracking the cost of that? I mean, when you talk about 16 human lifetime hours, it's hard to wrap my head around that, but I believe it. I mean, because I hear the anecdotal stories.
They'll tell you. You can see from, you know, and of course, IRS and tax compliance is a big part of that too, which could be simplified, and that could save a lot. But in terms of regulatory costs overall, there are, you know, of those 3,000 rules I mentioned every year, of course, less under Trump is 2,400, and most of those are just kind of nominal stuff. But of those rules, it's a very small handful that actually get cost-benefit analysis. But in my annual roundup, the 10,000 commandments, I use a placeholder basically of around $2 trillion annually for the cost of regulation when you're thinking about compliance and so forth. And some of that is the paperwork hours. It's IRS, it's energy, environmental, just different categories. But based on what government used to under the Regulatory Right to Know Act, it would acknowledge how many hours of paperwork were involved and had the costs of rules and regulations. But we don't really see those reports anymore. So based on that and then other reports I see from the from the National Association of Manufacturers has a report calling the cost of regulation around $3 trillion annually. Being conservative, I say $2 trillion. I say, well, think about that. That's what the size of the deficit is now. It's the size of the entire federal budget when you go back to the early 90s. It's the amount of it's greater in some years than the amount of individual taxes received. It's far larger than the corporate income tax receipts. It's close to the amount of yearly corporate profits. So when you talk about regulation, you're talking about a hidden tax. It's pretty gargantuan. We may say that it's not as big as spending, because spending is now $7 trillion. But on the other hand, it very well could be, because no one ever measures it.
Right. I mean, the bureaucracy's killing us, right? It keeps feeding itself, and in the end, it's killing us financially.
Yeah, it sure is. And I hope that's one of the things that gets addressed. You know, if you think about like a hierarchy of deconstruction of the administrative state, it was looking at, for example, you'll see Linda McMahon talking about abolishing the Department of Education and how they've cut subsidies and cut grants and so forth. A lot of that is wonderful, but also, you know, I said you have to have Congress to back this stuff up. She can't get rid of the Department of Education on her own. And so far, a lot of the programs are not, rather than being gotten rid of, they're being farmed out to state, to the Interior Department, to the Department of Labor. They're going to other places where, in effect, we got to be careful because we could be planting new seeds. You know, our founder, Fred Smith, would say, you know, it's a pruned weed is a healthy weed. When you roll these things back, you've got to be careful that you're actually creating a situation where you are on a path to abolition or termination. And frankly, that's the toughest stuff. You know, Trump has done the easy stuff. He froze Biden's rules. He got rid of some of the most egregious. He's avoided his own rulemakings, except for, you know, the kind of the swamp things that I'd mentioned earlier. But the toughest stuff is actually terminating agencies like and departments like education or energy, actually terminating them and their enabling statutes. That's the most important thing, especially because, you know, even government spending now is already on its own hyper-regulatory, because we've got the CARES Act. But in addition to the CARES Act, soon thereafter, we got the inflation law, the CHIPS and Science law, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act. All of these spending hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And a lot of that has regulatory strings attached, you know, to the grants and procurements and things like that. And unfortunately, a lot of that regulation that comes by that avenue doesn't wind up in the Federal Register that you and I've been talking about here this whole time. So there could be a lot of, you know, regulations already off the books, but you can even have this kind of regulatory dark matter that isn't appearing at all, even in the Federal Register.
Well, let me go take my half a bottle of Advil, because you have successfully got my head spinning and I've got a huge headache now. But you know, this is the untold
more in the future. Yeah,
this is kind of the untold story, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, when you think about these hidden tax, these nuances, when you're thinking about the regulatory side and just managing the rule to put it in place is an incredible cost, and then you have the litigation and everything that goes along with it. Yeah, we're going to have you back on for your, what is it called, 10,000?
10,000 commandments.
Yeah. 10,000 so commandments.
It'll be out over the next few months. It'll be a deeper compilation. And by that time, we'll have more of the hard data from the Trump administration. So, yeah, thank you so much for thinking of us and for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. Appreciate the time and the insight. Wayne Cruz, Fred L. Smith Fellow in Regulatory Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and text line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer. Jeff, we finally reached the end of the season. Saints end up 6-11. Losing their last game of the season to the Atlanta Falcons 19-17. Your thoughts about the game?
Yeah, we made it, man. I had my first piece of king cake today. I'm feeling good about it. It was an entertaining game. You didn't ruin your draft pick, you know, and it's what I appreciate about the Saints is they didn't have a lot of pieces. They could have easily just said, you know what, it's not worth winning. We're going to sit the players we have, you know, the guys that are out there, we could sit them down and maybe secure that number eight pick. They didn't do that. They went for it. You know, they didn't win it, but there was no tanking. And I think once you kind of open that box of saying we're not interested in winning, it's hard to shut it again. I think it's hard to pull that back in the locker room. So that's what I appreciate is, you know, despite having an offense that you would not have recognized based on the one you started the season with. I mean, you had four wide receivers who were either on the practice squad or not on the roster at all week one. You had three wide running backs who were either on the practice squad or not on the roster at all week one. Actually, I think none of the running backs were on the roster week one. None of them even got here until midway through the season. So the fact that you were able to make that game competitive, I think just says so much about the belief that's kind of in that room. And, yeah, so, you know, it's never fun to get swept by the Falcons. No one wants it. But if you had won that game, you would have been picking 11th and had a second-place schedule. And losing that game, you pick 8th and have a fourth-place schedule. So, you know, there's worse things.
Yeah, you know, I felt the same way. You and I have talked about this multiple times. I said, look, as long as they're competitive, I'm happy. I mean, you know, that's kind of the most you can ask for in a rebuild year, right? I mean, and I think there's value of the experience that Chuck and some of the other younger players received this year. He's likely to be maybe rookie of the year and actually didn't play, half the year, if that's my memory serves me correct, which that's a good thing, too, if that happens.
Yeah, I will have to see how that develops. I would be surprised if he won it. Not that I don't think he deserves it. I just think when push comes to shove, they're going to look at it and say, man, he only started 9 games. If he had won that game going to the end of the offseason on a 5-game win streak, you know, because the Rookie of the Year is a story award more than anything else, and that would have been one heck of a story. You know, the loss kind of takes the shine off of it. It doesn't mean that, you know, he's any less of a kind of revelation for this team at the quarterback position. I just think from a story perspective, the shine comes off it a little bit. But either way, I think the Saints are really, really excited about what they have at quarterback. I know his teammates are. You know, a lot of times it's funny because you'll hear players come out and, you know, they're always going to talk up their teammates. But in this case, it's like you hear DeMario Davis come out and like, this guy's got it. You know, I talked to Justin Reed and, you know, he was saying he told him he needs to take some time off in February to go to the awards ceremony because he's going to win Rookie of the Year. They believe in that guy. And it's cool to see. You know, I also thought it was cool to see, you know, the players that don't get a lot of opportunities get out there. You know, Ronnie Bell, that one-handed catch was really impressive for him. Samori Toure had a nice catch, even though the refs tried to take it away from him. I did think it was funny because in the moment I was like, man, that's a silly challenge. You're trying to take it from 3rd and 7 to 3rd and 4. But then I thought about it and was like, you know who probably appreciated that challenge was Samori Toure. Like, that's the only evidence he was in the game at all was that catch. And it was a heck of a catch anyway. I think there's just a lot that the Saints did this year that they're going to look at and say, hey, this is how we're building, right? Like, we felt like we were doing things the right way all year, and that's a frustrating thing when you feel that way and the results aren't coming. Well, in the second half of the season, you know, you had a lot of guys kind of staying the course. Everyone did things the way they were asked to do them. Everyone, you know, the vibes, the culture in the locker room was strong. And, you know, I think that's why there's so much positivity around this building is, you know, they all kind of kept that belief. They all kept pulling the rope in the same direction. And it resulted in a really kind of fun finish to the season, even if it finished outside of the playoffs. So there's a lot to build on. And, you know, Tyler Shuck is kind of at the center of that.
Yep. I kind of like that the Saints had double the rushing yards that the Falcons did. You know, they have a healthy running back and expected a lot more of him. And they were able, I think they held him to less than 50 yards, if my memory serves me correct. And, you know, which is, that's an accomplishment as well.
Yeah, one team went into that game with Audric Estime and Evan Hull. The other team went into that game with Bijan Robinson and Tyler Allgeier. One team came away with 108 rushing yards, and you got to give Tyler Shuck credit for some of that. He had 34 of his own. The other team came away with 49 total rushing yards. Bijan Robinson had 15 carries for 33 yards. That's 2.2 yards per carry. This is a man who ran for 193 yards less than a week ago against the Rams. like that's to me, you know, it's funny because you come out of that game and you lost the game. But to me, it's like the defense dominated that game. The Saints defense dominated that game. And it's a shame that you weren't able to win it because of that. Unfortunately, special teams was a problem in that game. Special teams has been a problem all year long. And to me, that's what cost you the game. You gave away a touchdown. The only touchdown the Falcons scored, the only time they even really threatened for a touchdown came after that block punt. That they started that drive at the 5-yard line. So, no, I mean, the defense over the second half of the season.
What was that, Jeff? Ahead. Did somebody miss the block? Did they miss their assignment? I mean, I looked at it a couple of times. I couldn't figure it out because it was like a mishmash of bodies. But, I mean, you know.
It looked like they kind of ran a stunt, which you don't see a lot of that on pump block. And I think the Saints just didn't pick it up well. And we don't get to talk to – normally we'd get to talk to Phil Galliano, special teams coordinator, but because it's week 18, we won't get that. So we won't necessarily get the explanation for what was supposed to happen versus what did happen. But, yeah, that one's not really on the punter. That's on the protection. Because, you know, you can leave guys unblocked, but you need those guys to be coming off the edge because it's just a longer – you know, they typically can't get there in time. You can't leave a free rusher up the middle, which is what you got. So someone messed up. I don't know exactly who it was. I don't want to sit here and tell you it was this guy's fault. But yeah, there was a mistake had there. And unfortunately for the Saints, and I think you go into the offseason saying, hey, where can you get better? Special teams just across the board is an area that you've got to get a lot better at. Because, you know, there was a lot of games this season where special teams was a liability. And at its best this year, it's been, okay, you're at least kind of breaking even. I don't think you could point to any game where it was a legitimate advantage for you, but you can point to several games where it was a legitimate disadvantage. So that's, you know, whether it's, you know, they need to be more consistent on making field goals, they need to be more consistent on coverage. I mean, heck, there was at least twice in that game the Falcons kicked the ball into the end zone, the Saints returned it anyway. And it's like, man, anytime that ball's going to land in the end zone, let it land in the end zone. Starting a drive at the 35-yard line is a win. You don't need to be trying to improve that. You're not Devin Hester. Like, let the ball bounce in the end zone. Don't run it back. It's really not that complicated, but it's happened way too many times this season. So that's a part of this equation that the Saints are going to have to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, if you start putting the math to that as to who, you know, feels the ball in the end zone or at the goal line and is able to move it past the 35-yard line, it's not that many times.
It's a low percentage.
Yeah. Let's see. We fumbled again. That's been a problem, right?
Yeah, I mean, not just the fumbles, but it's actually wild. I've never seen anything like this. I'm sure it's happened before, but the Saints, 5 times this season, they only have 17 games. 5 times this season, the Saints have fumbled on their opening offensive possession. Actually, 6, but they recovered it against the Titans. So that's not even just five times. It's back-to-back games you fumbled on your opening possession. And five of those times, you lost it. So it's like, you talk about a team that's starting slow. They've taken that to a whole new level of not only are you not scoring on your opening position, you're giving the ball to the other team a third of the time. So, yeah, I don't know what that is. I don't know if there's any common denominator. Like, two of them were Spencer Rattler. One of them was Alvin Kamara getting the ball knocked out. I take it back. It was Tyler Shuck who was trying to run a play action and the ball got knocked out of his hands. Another one was Taysom Hill, who fumbled on his opening possession or on his opening carry of the game. Another one was last week, obviously, Tyler Shuck got sacked and fumbled. This week it was Juwan Johnson. I think there's another one in there that I'm missing. But that's just, you can't do that. And I think that those are the types of small things that have cost you games this year. You know, what's the difference between going 6-11 and going maybe 9-8 and winning the division? It's those small things, right? It's having the momentum and giving it right back. It's getting a punt blocked when you just can't get a punt blocked. It's missing field goals in critical opportunities. It's not being able to punch it in from the 1 yard line. All that stuff adds up to, failing to win a division that all you had to do was scratch to an 8-9 record to get to it. And you couldn't do that. So those are kind of the things that you're going to look back on this season and say, yeah, okay, that cost us this season. But I think a lot of those things are correctable. So I think the Saints do have the benefit of being able to point to a lot of very specific things and say, if we can clean this up, if we can run for a yard when we need a yard, we can be a winning football team.
I wasn't paying close attention. I was doing some work while I was watching the game. Did we have many drop passes?
I'm not sure. I can't say. Tyler went 23 of 35, 259. It seemed like when he put the ball on guys, they caught it. I didn't notice any drops. There were some miscommunications, right? Like, there was a play early in the game where Kevin Austin was running kind of a dig over the middle of the field, and he kind of throttled down. Tyler thought he was going to keep going, and it was just a miss. I think it was more of a chemistry issue in that game, more so than an execution issue. There was a couple deep balls, go routes to, I want to say, Ronnie Bell, that they didn't connect on, and they connected later in the game. But yeah, it's hard to be too critical of a passing game when you have that many backups in there.
Yeah, no, it just kind of, it almost sometimes feel like it's infectious, when somebody, dropping the ball, and then all of a sudden everybody starts dropping the ball. It's just kind of one of those weird things. What do you expect to hear tomorrow? We're going to be covering you guys live out at Saints training camp at 11, Mickey Loomis and the coach. What do y'all expect to hear?
Yeah, I expect to hear kind of positive reviews and a lot of, positivity around how the team kind of stayed together and closed up this season. I'm more interested in hearing from Mickey than Kellen, because we talk to Kellen every week. We kind of know what he's going to say. I'm curious how Mickey feels about the team building, about how he feels about the draft class, and if he'll go into it, what he thinks this team needs, because it's going to be fascinating to see how they continue to build around Tyler Shuck. And Chris Olave is up for a contract extension. He's under contract, but it's a 1 year deal, so that's going to be the big story this offseason. How much do you pay Chris Olave? I'm curious what he has to say about Chris's season. But I think it's going to be a press conference that strikes a very positive tone and a positive chord, because it should be, because I think this team feels like after a while of kind of being in the woods, they're kind of finding their way out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Look forward to hearing it and checking in with you guys tomorrow at 11 live. Thank you so much for joining us today. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer. Great job this year, Jeff. Really appreciate it.
Sounds good, Neil. Thanks for having me on all these weeks.
All righty. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. So some of the out-migration numbers have been delayed and being reported by the Census Bureau, but U-Haul has released their information. And what they do is they track one-way rentals. Customers who rented a one-way truck, trailer, or U-Box moving containers in one state and dropped off their equipment in another state. The U-Haul Growth Index compiled from well over 2.5 million annual one-way transactions across the U.S. and Canada. And, you know, these rankings don't directly correlate to population or economic growth, but the index is an effective gauge of how well states, metros, cities are attracting and maintaining residents. Well, the worst performers were mostly deep blue states. California ranking dead last for the sixth consecutive year, although U-Haul noted that their loss in 2025 was smaller than in 2024. Of the 11 biggest losers, eight of them are completely blue governments: California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, Maryland, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. And two others, Pennsylvania and Michigan, have had Democratic governors and largely Democratic governance for some time. The lone red exception is Ohio, which also had the biggest one-year drop-off. Now, a blue state actually enjoys the largest year-over-year climb on the index, ranking as a net gain in Oregon, a net gain in 2025 after ranking 34 as a net loss in 2024, a jump of 23 positions. And other notable gainers: Mississippi, plus 18, Colorado, plus 17, Nevada, plus 15, New Mexico, plus 15, Louisiana, plus 13, and Montana, plus 12. And as I said earlier, Ohio's had the largest year-over-year drop on the index, falling 29 positions to 43rd. And obviously, this is just one snippet of these numbers. We'll dig deeper into these numbers and report them out to you later. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Well, folks, Scoot's headed your way, and he joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, it's January the 6th. You know, this is a very exciting day because this is the official beginning of the carnival season, King Cake Day. And also, we'll talk about the anniversary of January 6th, the attack on the U.S. Capitol.
All righty, folks. Scoot's got a great lineup headed your way. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoy Tuesday evening.